Hey y'all, welcome back to But Not All at Once, the podcast for people who aren't 100% confident what the date is. We could probably make an educated guess, take a stab at maybe a general range, but if you want specificity, we're going to need to consult Siri or our children. I'm your host, Ann Smith. Hopefully your ducks are all in a row, but if, as I am, you are holding on to what's left of May, tooth and nail, watching the things pile back up in the calendar that perhaps haven't been there in about 14 months, I welcome you. There's a lot going on, but not all at once. I have, I think, 4 interviews on the calendar this week, one of which is with Meredith Jaggard, our very first ever podcast guest, who was kind enough to come here sight unseen, podcast unheard. And she has a lot to tell us about continuing to kick multiple sclerosis right in the teeth, about a cross-country move that became a different cross-country move, and how she's living that vegan plus pizza life with a toddler alongside her and her husband. I will be recording with her the end of this week. Feel free to send me questions if you are dying to know what her family of three has been up to. And then her update episode will be on Patreon early next week. I can't wait to share it with you. If you are not a subscriber, for $3 a month, you get really cool things like giveaways, access to people like Meredith. We have several former guests who are coming back in the next month, and I can't wait to share all of that with you. It's at patreon.com/butnotallatonce. This week's episode is Ashley Adams. She has a story that she has volunteered to tell so many times over the last year that it was incredible. We just couldn't find a spot to make it work, and now here she is, vulnerable as ever, mother of three, author of 2 books, and a survivor of a marriage mired in substance abuse. Her first husband struggled with alcoholism, and the decision to stay or leave, to separate oneself mentally, emotionally, even after you're out of the marriage, and then to have to break the news to your children that their father has died because of his addiction. It's a story that is just going to leave you, A, wanting to hug everyone you love in your life, B, really hopeful about what beautiful families can come from really hard times, and C, I think we're on C, right? Not 3. C, just thankful for people like Ashley who are willing to lay bare the happiest and hardest moments of their life. And that is why But Not All At Once exists. I can't wait for you to listen to this story. This is Ashley. I'm here with Ashley Adams, who has been gracious and patient enough to wait for a spot to open up in our calendar for probably the better part of a year and a half now. And I'm so glad you have.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here. It has been just a joy listening to your podcast over the last year or so. And I feel like I know you so well, and I'm so excited to chat with you.
Well, I'm really glad you're here. And I would love for you to introduce yourself to everyone, who you are, what you do, what your family looks like today. It's kind of a little preview / postscript for kind of what we're going to talk about in that middle space.
Yes, happy to. So Ashley Adams, I am based out of Richmond, Virginia. And I am a marketer by day, full-time work, supporting a lot of small businesses for a financial services company. And I have written a couple books at this point, something that I never really thought I was going to do. I think it was like a middle school dream of writing.
Yeah.
And then who knew that was
ever
going
to
become
a thing.
Right? Yeah. And really those books came about, which, you know, we'll get into, but I went through a pretty traumatic first marriage, and when I needed a resource, I couldn't find one. Mm. And so I kind of journaled my experiences. Yep. And then once I was out of that pain and kind of through to the other side of it, figured out how to publish a book and got that out there for the world. And actually my second book just came out this year as well, as kind of a follow-up to that, that it just kind of fed nicely. I didn't know that there'd be a second book after the first, but it just kind of fell into place.
I love that. And I think the most powerful, you know, they say necessity is the mother of invention. And I think in creative fields, when you look around for something that you desperately need and it doesn't exist, then you're the woman being called to fill that void.
That's right. That's right. I mean, mine are about my first marriage, and you know, that is a very isolating and painful time. And to feel like you're the only one going through that, like that's awful. So I knew I wasn't the only one. So I didn't want others to feel that way in the future.
And I know you have children. How old are your children? What genders do you have?
Yes, I have three children, 2, 7, and 10. So deep in the elementary years. And then I am since remarried. So hence the two-year-old. I get that question all the time, which always blows my mind to your point of just like, congratulations, the end. There's right. always follow-ups.
There's never a need to follow up. You will find out. If you need to know, you'll be told.
That's right.
100%. I love, I was asked this today, and our children, we don't have any gaps. We were just rapid fire, just boom, boom, boom. But someone has still asked me in the last couple of weeks if our five-year-old in her final months of preschool was an accident. And can I just put it out in the universe that, you know, a happy surprise, a delightful veer off of your plan. I don't know what words you want to use, but that's also for your parents to the parent to use. That's not for a random stranger at the grocery store to ask you.
Yes, because on the outside, my family looks totally typical, and sure. so that is what it looks like to everyone. Oh, yeah. Another one just surprised you.
Little
down
happy
the road,
accident.
Huh?
Yeah, and also it changes your life not at all. To understand right. the conception of everyone's every child, it'll be all right. So just say how beautiful, what a lovely family, and let it run.
That's right.
Let it go. So let's talk about how you got this beautiful family and what long, broken, hard, and beautiful road you've taken to get to where you are now. Because we all know that you can't write a book raw and bleeding. You have to wait till it heals a bit to really be of value to anyone around you or to anyone kind of coming behind you. So let's talk about the pre-scabbed over part of your path.
Yeah. So I met my first husband in college. I was a junior in college. He was actually already working as a professional. So we had a 4-year age gap between us. And I was one of those people who I think always just hoped my life was going to unfold so easily and beautifully, just like a fairy tale. We were married very shortly after I graduated college. So at 23, we got married. Our relationship had been really nice, although, like, candidly, I don't know that I pictured him as my husband when we were first together. I actually spent my very last semester abroad, and I thought that was going to be the end of our relationship.
Right. Yeah, I can see that.
And then that didn't happen. So so I came back, we ended up getting engaged. And, you know, here's me wanting to follow all of the rules. So I said, well, it makes sense that we would live together, but we can't live together unless we're at least engaged. So I kind of, you know, orchestrated a lot of hurrying into something that obviously should not have been hurried. We'd been together for several years at that point. But we got married. During our engagement, I had no red flags during our relationship, but during our engagement, a cousin who was very close to him died in a car accident. And he had just immense grief during that time period and was drinking very, very heavily. It was very hard to watch.
Tell me what you mean by very, very heavily at that point.
So at that point, at least what I saw and what I still know to be true, it would be most nights, it would be, you know, maybe like 4, 5, 6 beers. It was like a constant and it was just an everyday thing. If I'd be gone for work and I'd come home and I'd see, because he worked in a restaurant, so he had different hours too. And so alcohol tends to flow a little more freely in those kind of lifestyles. And so it was just, it was hard to watch. But at that point, I had no reason to believe it was anything other than grief. While not a healthy way to cope with loss, a very common way. And so that's really what I chalked it up to at the time. Here I am 23. What do I know as any better? I had just come out of college where I drank heavily and I didn't have a problem. I was living like a college life. And that was kind of
very normal at that point.
Right. Yeah. Yep. So it was not a red flag from the time. It gave me pause and it made me nervous, but it made me more nervous of, oh, he needs help for being in grief right now. Mm-hmm.
And in terms of his family, were there any red flags of other folks with substance abuse issues, anything else that would have made you think, huh, this might be a pattern?
Not at the time.
I mean, I wouldn't have known at 23, to be clear.
Exactly.
I just want you to know that straight out. I had zero perspective on the wider world, so I wouldn't blame you if there were red flags at go-go and you didn't catch them.
Exactly. Not at the time. There are things that I think revealed themselves later to be more of where you can see it has genetic backing to it, but they were not things I saw at the time. So we were married and we had our first daughter 4 years later, Peyton. And that was, you know, a mostly typical pregnancy. I think what was hard for me at the time was I was not drinking anymore.
Sure. Right.
And he was continuing to drink. At some point during that pregnancy, there became this delineation of, okay, here's where Jeff is a good drunk, and here's when he is not a good drunk. Beer seems to be okay. Whiskey seems to be not so okay. So I just started seeing more patterns develop. Again, at that point, I never suspected any sort of alcoholism. It was more, there's a problem here. There's something going on. We even had this, I should say it was our breaking point, but it was not. We were together for many years after. When my daughter was 2 weeks old, he had had a significant amount to drink. And I actually had to lock myself in a room away from him. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, my first instinct was not to call the police. It was to call his brother, who lived 600 miles away. Mm-mm. And I said, hey, call your brother.
Right.
Like, it just, it never even dawned on me to call the police. Mostly because I think, like, looking back, I didn't want that embarrassment. I didn't want cars in my little suburban cul-de-sac.
Right. Who's looking? What do they think?
Exactly. Nobody knew what was going on in our lives at that time. So I wasn't at that point ready for the world to know. So we ended up trying counseling during that first year after that. Jeff saw this counselor individually, and then we came as a couple as well. And it was not, I don't know, like, counseling has, you know, become so much more popular and, like, spoken about since that time. But I think for us at the time, we didn't know that, okay, if this person's not a great fit for us, we should try someone else. Or if you can't open up to this person, let's try someone else.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I loved this. I loved this woman. And I think he liked her too. But I think the deeper issue was he was so heavy in denial that she couldn't get truth out of him. She wasn't going to be able to work with us as a couple. So I think we got a couple of basic issues worked out. We got in a better space after we made it through the newborn haze. Like, year one was not a great year for him, but then he became just like this great father after that. And he did awesome through the toddler stages, and he was very engaging. And suddenly we felt like we were outgrowing our 3-bedroom starter house. And so we started, like, getting on the hunt for our forever home. He was motivated to work on a house, and, like, things just seemed really good. And then we got pregnant with our second child, my son Ryan, and he and Jeff was checked out for most of that. He was not helpful. He was very anxious. Like, that was really where I started to see a lot more of the anxious behavior from him.
And do you feel like that was, I mean, I know this is a tricky question to untangle, but do you feel like the anxiety was fueling the alcohol dependence, or do you feel like the alcohol was fueling the anxiety?
I think what I know about alcoholism now, I think they just go together hand in hand.
Yeah.
I think the alcoholism absolutely fuels anxiety, but I also think anxious people tend to be a little more susceptible to alcohol abuse. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's a good watch out to be aware of. Interestingly, he actually lost his job halfway through our pregnancy. And
that is not interesting. That's terrifying.
Yes.
That would give a hormonal lady a heart attack.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and he had all sorts of reasons of, like, why this happened.
What year was this? Was this, like...
So this was, like, year four.
So, like, 2000...
Let's see. So that would have been, like, 2012, 2013.
Okay.
Yeah. That was a lot.
Yeah.
And people like to tell you all sorts of things after the fact. No one wants to tell you what's happening in the moment.
Of course.
I learned all sorts of things after the fact. Apparently, he had been going out to his car at lunch and drinking. He had been taking money from a cash box. Like, I had no clue any of this was happening. You know, his reasons for why he lost his job were so silly. And I said, these make no sense. How could you lose your job for this?
And how could they do this to you?
Right. I was like, here I am furiously, like, ready to write some HR letter and, like, go to the...
Food and beverage at this point?
Yeah, he was in food and beverage. He had normal hours at this point. He was not in a restaurant. So he had like a nice management job supporting like a food and beverage industry. And he ended up getting a great follow-up job too after that. And what was interesting there is they had such great benefits that shortly after our son was born, his anxiety was just through the roof. And I had been in sales prior and I knew that, you know, you could get out on short-term disability with stress, with a doctor's note. Right. So I said, why don't you go to your doctor, see what he says? And he wrote him out that day. Well, his insurance was so good that he got short-term disability for 6 months.
And FYI, a woman who just gave birth does not get that luxury. We will discuss that on a different episode on a different day, but I just want to put that little asterisk in there. Okay, carry on.
So here I am thinking, well, this will be great for him. He can de-stress. He can do some things that he enjoys and really like try and like work on himself. But that did not happen. Mm. He loved being home. We were even trying to save money with daycare. And so I was having him watch our new son a couple days a week to save on daycare costs. He was still on anxiety medications, which, you know, he blamed his erratic behavior on that. He had shakes. He would vomit in the morning and he blamed all of this on his medicine.
Oh, no.
And again, all of these things, you can look back and you say, well, you're such an idiot. Why didn't you see all of this?
But you're trying to keep your head above water with two kids and a husband who's home on short-term disability.
Very true.
You're believing what the man you love is feeding you, of course.
Yes.
And he may very well have passed a polygraph and been able to believe it himself.
Probably could have. Yeah. it was a lot. And then what was challenging with that is you could Google the symptoms of these medications. And yes, those are symptoms. So it all tracks. Where I still got suspicious, and I think that's like the key and what's so hard for being in a relationship like this is you're always suspicious. Like it can never just be surface level. It can't, like, he can't just tell me something and I just believe it. I always have to wonder.
Right.
Yes. I always have to wonder what else. My sister-in-law, who's just a joy and a wonderful, wonderful human, is also a recovering alcoholic and she's been sober. Gosh, I bet 12 or 15 years now. She's just incredible. And
so this is his sister.
It's actually his sister-in-law. So his brother's wife.
Okay.
Yep. And she was actually the one who told me, you know, his symptoms are a lot like mine were when I was at my worst. It may not be from the medicine. And she's very careful to never like assign blame, but she always just like, she'll make me just wonder. And it wasn't until 2 days after my birthday, our son is at this point 8 months old. I walk in on him pouring whiskey into a soda can at 7:30 in the morning.
Oof.
And now I know.
Yeah. And I mean, and that's my next question. So do you have a fully stocked bar? Does anyone keep an eye on consumption or, I mean, is he hiding purchases?
Yeah. So that's again, where it starts to make you feel like you're going crazy. I drink wine. He's not a wine drinker. We would buy like a case of Miller Lite or something and it would sit in our garage fridge. And he would like open a beer and then he'd be asleep on the couch, but the beer is still half full. And I'm like, oh, okay. So clearly it's the medicine. It just makes him tired.
Right.
Except what he was so good at was hiding handles of liquor that he would buy at the store. After he had left, I found in our couch, he had cut holes in the back of the couch and in the liner, he had stored all like, I bet I found a dozen handles. And so it was just all so sneaky and I just didn't know.
How could you? Really just keeping your head above water with two small children is a lot. And a job. At what point do you start to say, I don't know if this is good for us. I don't know what we can do here.
Well, it wasn't at that point.
Yeah.
At that point, I had always kind of grown up. I didn't believe in divorce. It was something that prior to going through it, I was kind of judgy about it. Like, I feel like you get married and you're in it.
Isn't that the story, by the way, of everything we've ever heard? Prior to going through fill in the blank, X, whatever it is, I was kind of judgy. And then you walk through it and your heart breaks wide open and you see all the shades of gray you ever overlooked.
Oh my gosh, the shades of gray, yes.
So whether it's divorce or addiction or any other thing, whoever's listening, I just want to say that is a universal truth. Until you have walked through that, you will never really own up to how, at least for me, how judgy and superior
right.
I can be about a number of things. So divorce wasn't a word that was maybe at the forefront of your mind, or maybe even in the top 10 solutions to what you were facing. So what was kind of your next step?
So my next step, he was so apologetic. And truthfully, he probably was. I mean, he was in such a bad state at that time. And he said, help me. I want help. And so here I am. I'm going into planning mode. I'm ready to rock this. So we attempted recovery at home. He went through withdrawals and it was terrible. The shakes, sweating, vomiting for 3 days. I was on the phone with my sister-in-law a ton, just trying to understand, because she's also a doctor. So also to understand, do I take him to the ER? Is this okay? Is this okay?
So his family is aware.
At this point, his family is aware.
Yeah.
Yes. I can't remember. Maybe just his brother and sister-in-law. But yes, the rest of the family would very quickly become aware. He said he never wanted to drink again. He wanted my help to stop. He agreed to try AA. And we actually went to our first two meetings, his first two meetings together. I think for me, that was a really pivotal moment for me, because naturally, I've never been inside of an AA meeting. And I just have to say to anyone who is a recovering alcoholic, to anyone who is attempting it, it is the hardest thing I think people could go through. And to watch the bravery of the folks in that room talk about what they've lost, talk about what they have fought for, talk about why they stay away from drinking. It is so inspiring. Mm. And like a recovering alcoholic, I mean, I was blown away in that room.
That's when I went to those meetings.
Yes. He stayed sober 6 days before he took his first drink again.
Oh. And were you aware when that happened?
Can't remember if he admitted that one or not.
Right?
I'm still working. Yep. Yeah. I'm still working. He is obviously no longer alone with the kids. We've put the baby back in daycare full time. I think that was incredibly hard for me too. I'm sitting here like, oh my gosh, I let him drive. I let him do this. He was with this baby all day long.
And so he was drinking before he drove.
I'm sure. Yes, I am sure. But he had bought a drink from a convenience store down the street so he could celebrate when he hit 30 days sober.
Mm.
But then he couldn't explain to me why he had opened it on day six. So I kind of knew at that point, I'm going to give him a 3 strikes and you're out rule. One of the things that I had either been told or read was like, don't go snooping, which was really hard for me as a snooper.
Yeah.
But the third time he's caught drinking, he'd have to leave. And so that was kind of what we had set out. What I wasn't prepared for is just how quickly that would happen. And then what was hard for me is I knew he had not hit rock bottom. And from everything I'd been doing with my research, I knew that's where he had to be. Like, he can't go to rehab if he doesn't really think he needs to be there yet. It's not going to work. But his parents were very insistent. And then I didn't trust them to find a place for him and like bother checking with our insurance and seeing what's covered.
Right.
And I didn't want to be stuck with a $15,000 bill.
Of course.
So I ended up doing the research reluctantly and kind of finding a couple of options. And that's kind of what we started prepping for. So from the time
that
he
involved in this conversation,
he knew it was coming, but he was not involved in it. It wasn't like a surprise one day that we sent him to rehab. Like, he was involved towards the end of it because it had gotten bad again. He couldn't stop. But he also here he is, this person who hasn't had responsibilities in over 6 months. He's been sitting at home and, you know, just getting so comfortable drinking and being at home and watching TV and not really having a lot of life responsibilities.
And that's all on you.
Yeah.
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 That's a lot. It's a lot for a woman with a full, involved, engaged partner. And it's a lot, I'm sure.
I know. I think back and, you know, the adrenaline comes to you. Somehow we survive it and we do it. But when I think like, gosh, that baby didn't sleep until he was after a year old. How did I get up multiple times a night, take care of him, have a 2-year-old at home too? Yeah, you just do it.
Yeah. You don't, you're running on fumes.
Yes.
I'm sure your immune system and your little nervous system were just shot to pieces.
Yes, I'm sure. A year later, I'd had walking pneumonia and the doctor was like, well, didn't you tell? Couldn't you feel? And I said, lady, I am a single mom with a 1 and a 3-year-old. No, I didn't notice that I was extra tired. I'm always tired.
That's adorable, Doc.
Right.
So you send him to rehab. How old are your children at this point?
So they are 9 months and 2.
And how does that feel? Does that feel like I'm doing the right thing? Does it feel like I'm abandoning him? Does it feel like there's no other way out?
At that point, like, I still was mad he was going to rehab because I knew he wasn't ready, but I was so hopeful. I was so naively thinking that this would fix him. Because as someone who's not addicted to a substance, I thought, surely if you can abstain for 30 days, you can do it.
We're over it.
Right. And that is such a naive perspective.
So it was a 30-day program.
30-day program.
Did you speak to him?
So I did. And I wish I had listened to my sister-in-law who said he really needs this time by himself. But I am an empath through and through, and all I wanted was him to feel supported and loved. Right. I had, this was, you know, finally now friends and family knew. I had friends and family sending him cards and letters of support, sending him snacks. I went up and visited him and took one of the kids with me every weekend on this 4-hour drive. Like, I was in it with him. They gave classes to family members on the weekends to learn more about alcoholism, how to, like, work through it with him. Like, I was in it. I was sure.
Al-Anon. Is that a thing? Al-Anon? Yep. Yeah. Yep. Is that what a program that you did?
So I didn't do, I went to a couple Al-Anon classes. Okay. It ended up, and I can share that actually ended up being one of my turning points, was one of those meetings that I attended. But this was actually taught, this was like classes for people going through it. And so I learned about like the brain chemistry and how alcohol changes your brain and what's happening to these people and why it's so hard. So it was really helpful. I'm glad I did that portion, but I certainly regret being like as loving and involved, which sounds weird to say, but I think it would have been much more beneficial. But it was so encouraging. You know, we'd go up and we'd have counselor sessions on the weekends and his counselor was like just singing his praises because, well, Jeff is leading our AA meetings now, or he is mentoring our newbies and like just all of these great things. His brother and I thought like, wow, well, maybe he's found his new calling and he can do something with this as a career. And like, we were so hopeful. But then his very last night in rehab, we were on the phone because they actually let him call most nights. Because one of the things that I always share with my friends when they have kids, I say, alternate bedtimes. Don't let just one person do bedtime. Because if something ever happens to you, you're in trouble.
Or you just want to leave the house. Yeah. Right.
And bedtime was his time with my oldest, mostly because I had the baby. And so I was always putting him to bed at the same time. And so they were really sweet. And they had him call every night to talk to her just to help me not have like an hour of meltdowns. And he and I were talking on his last night. And I asked him, because I knew that the very first day they're home, they're supposed to go to an AA meeting and like have everything planned out for where they're going to go and like what their first few days is going to look like. And he said, you know, I think I'm going to take the week. This was a Friday. I was picking him up. I'm going to take the weekend off and start on Monday. Ooh. And in that moment, I cried the entire night. I knew that was it. I knew it hadn't worked and I knew we weren't going to make it. So I picked him up on a Friday afternoon, Saturday morning. It was the end of spring. Our pool was opening. We're in walking distance to our little neighborhood pool, and we had forgotten something back at the house. And he was gone for like a half hour, going to pick up something that's, you know, a block away. I come to find out he had asked our neighbor if she had any beer that morning, and he had 2 at 10 a.m. before joining us at the pool. So he hadn't even been home 24 hours. I didn't know at the time because we didn't have any alcohol at the house when he came home. So it took me a few days to start picking up on it. But by Wednesday, I could tell that he was drunk. And he admitted to taking our oldest home from daycare without a car seat. She was 3. And that was the first day I had let myself go to Al-Anon after work. It was the first day I was like, okay, can you handle this? And so then I was like kicking myself. But what's so funny, and I think what always stands out to me of everything that I went through is all these people and things that come into your life that just start like painting this picture for you. The woman who spoke that night talked about how she thought she was in the clear. Her husband had been sober for like 3 or 4 years, and she had flown across the country to a conference. And while she was there across the country, she gets a call from the police that he had gotten a DUI with the kids in the car. And I sat in that meeting and I thought, oh my gosh, I cannot live my life in fear like that. Mm. I couldn't imagine every day, on top of all of the other stresses as a mother, as a working mother, like I just couldn't worry about that too.
Right.
So I knew I was going to have a zero tolerance policy when he came home. I didn't know it was only going to last a week. So I obviously couldn't make him leave like while he was drunk that night. So I sent him up to bed. And the next day,
how did he get drunk?
I mean, he could still drive and he had, you know, access to money. So he went and just got something, I guess. And I think on the one hand, grateful for small favors. He did always drink at home. He was never someone like that was really like out drinking and driving, that was at bars, you know, throwing away a ton of money that way. So I'm grateful for that, but doesn't make it easier. So the next day I came home from work and he was hammered and I knew he needed to be out of the house. But I tried to send him up to bed again. He was yelling while I was trying to feed the kids dinner for accusing him of being drunk, even though he very clearly was. So at that point, I said, you need to go upstairs to bed or you need to leave. And he chose to leave. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why this was the moment I decided to call the cops. I didn't even know if what he was doing, like, I don't even know why I'm calling. Yeah, I don't even know what I'm calling the cops for. you're leaving the house, but I know you're drunk.
Yeah.
But so as I started doing that, he, in that moment, started chasing me to try and get the phone. This was back in the day we still had a house phone. So I ran out of my house with the phone towards my neighbor's house and he grabbed me by my ponytail and threw the phone as I was dialing. So apparently I had dialed all the way through because after he'd peeled out of the driveway, they called me back to ask like if I needed help and the cop showed up. And that entire moment cascaded so much during our divorce process that I'm so grateful for. And I wish I had had the foresight in earlier situations to call, but clearly what I learned was it took like a moment of crazy for me to decide I'm going to call. I don't care now if people know, because we never told our neighbors. I think we had told, like, we had very dear friends who lived across the street. That's whose house I was running to. And they knew, but no one else knew.
So you waited until he crossed whatever line he did at that moment. You called the police. And would you say that was the end of your marriage?
Yes. Yep. And what happened that night, again, I didn't know anything about divorce. I didn't know anything about having cops. I'd never really talked to a cop. I'd gotten a couple speeding tickets in my life, but that's about it. So for those who don't know, there are things called protective orders, which are similar to a restraining order. And because of the incident at our house, they actually called in what's called an emergency protective order. And it lasts for, I think, 48 hours or long enough that you're able then to follow up with a judge. And then you can choose to extend it for 2 weeks up to 2 years. So they did that, which then meant he could not come back to the house. Funny enough, he, in his drunken state, tried to book a month at a hotel.
Okay.
Only cash he had access to is a debit card. So I did not have that much cash in the debit card for him, thankfully. And that was really kind of what set us up for me to really have the upper hand of safety for my kids, because that was my biggest fear of he's done this in secret for so long. What would stop a judge from assuming positive intent and giving him access to these kids? And that was for someone who believed in marriage and was willing to do whatever it took. At the end of the day, I just could not put my children through that. And actually, what really convinced me was I had several friends or colleagues that had grown up with an alcoholic parent. And I asked them, I was like, what do you wish your mom or your dad had done? And they said they wish they had left, every single one of them. And I said, okay, that's what I do.
So what did your family say at this point? Did they get it? All of them?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it just made so much sense.
Yeah.
He was, you know, an extroverted person. And what was so hard about it is he's such a lovable guy and so personable and so just fun up until he's not. He's someone who eventually is going to be the one embarrassing you at a party, at a wedding. But in general, he is so beloved. And I think it was just really hard. I think it was hard for people. They were completely supportive, but I think just so much pity and sadness for him, for me, for the kids, because we didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't know if he was going to end up in jail, end up dead in a gutter. We didn't know what would happen.
Because he's not working.
Right.
And the kids, how does that affect them immediately? Because they're little, right?
Yeah. Yes. So immediately, not really an impact. Obviously, the baby, totally fine. Didn't really have right. much of a sense. Right. My daughter had been used to him being gone for the last month. So mm-hmm. we had like some understanding of that. And the story that we told her at the time, because they just don't have a sense of permanence and understanding at sure. that age. So for her, it was, he is working out of town, or he's staying with, you know, his mom and dad. And so it was more about like work is keeping him away, because he was very inconsistent. We didn't know when he'd be able to talk to her because of our protective order.
So now you're a single mom of two small children. Yeah. And do you feel that weight, or are you still at that adrenaline, running on fumes, walking pneumonia yeah. kind of woman? Where are you in that?
At that point, I remember when I went to, first of all, I didn't even know how to find a lawyer. Like, I didn't even know what to do. I was only 30 years old, 31 at this time. I think I just turned 31. I had no friends who were divorced. I barely had friends that were married. And I didn't know any of the steps that I needed to take.
Yeah.
Which is what led me to write book number two. Because
exactly.
obviously I'm not the only one.
You couldn't find it.
Right. So when I ended up finding my lawyer, I remember I wrote her a $5,000 check, and I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I just had to write $5,000. Right. But I got in my car, I put my window down, and I just breathed like the deepest breath. It just was like, I am not in charge. So I just gave money for someone else to be in charge and deal with this. And it felt so freeing. Good.
Yeah. Yes. Someone's in your corner.
Yes. And she was a shark. I hated her. Like, I was like, maybe this is what a lawyer should be. Like, I shouldn't like her, because that's like what I need in the courtroom.
She's good at her job.
Right.
Yeah.
But she just like, she pushed for things that I would not have pushed for. She ended up getting him to agree to the full 2-year protective order, which was totally not necessary. I was not in fear of my life, but there were so many positives to that. It meant for sure he could not come back to our house. It meant for right. sure I had some leverage if I want him to, you know, work through whatever a property settlement looks like, whatever custody looks like. He had some reason to do it if he wants to be able to speak to me and see me, which he very much did. And that was hard, because he was so heavy in his drinking at the time that it was all my fault. Still, why are you doing this? Let's just talk. Why won't you talk to me? Like, this is behind us now. What did I do wrong?
So this is ongoing.
Mm-hmm. And that went on for, I think it was probably 6 months or so before we actually like settled. His parents ended up helping him and got him a lawyer, which was, I totally understand. Like, as a parent, you have to support your kid. But it was disappointing, because his parents were very much in denial of what was happening and believing that he was drinking as much as he was and everything that happened. Which is a shame, because his dad, actually, the day after the police incident at our house, his dad came to pick him up, and Jeff followed him back to our house. This is, you know, again, where people are not in the right mindset. He wanted to pick up his Xbox. And the police still hadn't been able to serve him his warrant. And I said, he's coming to the house. I am sure he will be drunk if you would like to breathalyze him.
Oh.
And sure enough, he blew a .16. And this was at like 11 o'clock. And he passed his field sobriety test at .16. Wow. Like, that's how normal it was for him.
Right.
That was a big wake up as well.
But obviously not enough for his parents.
No. Yeah. No. And so his lawyer never had like accurate information on the situation, and just like kept pushing for him not to sign to get a more equitable deal, which was really hard for me as someone who, you know, my dad's a financial investor or financial advisor, and I grew up like I had really good money management skills, and I'm like, dang, I don't want to give this guy half of my 401k. He doesn't deserve this. Like, right. our kids deserve this. And right. it was really hard to let go of some of that stuff to figure out, like, can I stay in this house? I didn't know. Like, I was trying to do the math. I was very fortunate because I was the breadwinner in our house. I think some of the women that I met, I started attending divorce care through my church, which, you know, again, this church I found because it was the very first AA meeting we went to together. And I walked in and I just like felt like, oh, this place feels like the kids would like this. We should come back here. And it was one of like two places within a 70-mile radius that was offering this program called Divorce Care, which I recommend to so many people because it's video-based, like just all of the things with divorce. And if you don't feel like talking, you don't have to, but it is a great way to learn and to hear other people's stories. And I made several very good friends through that. And they were stay-at-home moms when they left. And like the bravery of that, like that's incredible.
Yeah, that's a different situation entirely. So when you get to the other side of, you've got this 2-year protective order, obviously custody is yours. Do you just prepare to raise these children on your own?
Yeah. So I'd kind of, our protective order ended up not lasting 2 years. It lasted about 6 months until he signed our custody and property settlement. But at that point, when we were able to talk again, that was again, when he just didn't get it. And I was in this mindset of healing at that point. I was hurting and I was exhausted all the time. But I was doing all the steps to like not let this happen to me again. You know, I think one of the hardest things for people who do go through with a divorce is then hear the rest of the statistics of like, well, you're screwed. I mean, your next marriage is going to suck too. And it's really hard to read statistics and to, especially when you think about your kids and like what it does to them. And then I just had to keep telling myself, my kids are not a statistic. My kids are my kids. They are not a statistic. And just focusing on how unique our situation is and what we can do to make it better. How can I make it better for them? What will they need in the future? And, you know, by this point they are 2 and 4, and you know, what man wants to date someone who's 2 and 4 or has kids that are 2 and 4? So I just kind of resigned myself to the fact that I'm just going to be single and I'm going to be okay with that. And I think that was a big moment for me too, because that's part of what led me to my first marriage was this desire to have this happy ending and get married and have my 2 kids and live in the suburbs. And I did that and it didn't work out.
Right. And so how did that next chapter unfold then? Accepting kind of what you envisioned as just a family as the 3 of you?
Mm-hmm. I think it was very challenging always having to explain things to my 3-year-old or 4-year-old at that time now. Again, not understanding the permanence, not understanding why her dad doesn't see her. I had, as part of our custody agreement, he had to be breathalyzed anytime he was taking them somewhere or doing something with them. He didn't even have to be driving. The very first time I asked him, he said, "No, you're dead to me." And we didn't see him anymore. He would talk to her on the phone every now and then.
Yeah.
But for the next 6 months, we didn't see him. And that was painful. So hard. Yeah. He just shut down. He got a new girlfriend who I was constantly paranoid he was going to get pregnant somehow. I was like, oh, that's the last thing we need here.
And how do you explain that to a preschooler when adults can't untangle the truth of this?
I mean, I think the good thing at that age is, again, without the sense of permanence, you can kind of keep things very high level of, well, he lives in another city, so it's hard for him to come down. And she doesn't remember that it's been so long. She just knows I haven't seen him, and she doesn't understand the concept of, well, it's been a week or it's been 5 weeks. Or so that made it easier. Now, I was constantly nervous for the future. And all I could picture was, how did I get myself in the situation where my kids are potentially going to have a deadbeat dad? How am I going to raise children and say, sorry, your dad hasn't seen you in 3 years or whatever it's going to be?
That's so much of a burden on you when none of that is your doing.
Yeah. But as moms, all I thought about was like, how do I protect them? And I actually did not grow up religious. And, you know, as many people do when they go through a hard time is when they find God. And, you know, I mentioned that I found this church through the first AA meeting, and I'd been looking for a church because I wanted my kids to be baptized. And I didn't know that you needed to like be a member of a church to get them baptized. And so I started going, and I found so much peace. And I literally cried every Sunday in the sermon. It was like my time. I loved going, and the kids had phenomenal youth programs, and they just loved it. But I think what was great for me was I was able to release a lot of that stress and that pain and just say, please, if he is going to be in their lives, you know, let him be in their lives. If he is going to be out of their lives, let him be out of their lives. And I just kind of had to let that go and let God work through that for me, not knowing if he would and how that would look. But, you know, I can fast forward to that fall, our divorce had been finalized by this point. It's hard to believe this was all only like a year and a half. But our divorce had been finalized, right? My son is barely two. My daughter has just started kindergarten. It is the first anniversary that we were going to be apart, like legally divorced. Mm-hmm. And that night his brother called me, and here I am like happily like answering the phone. Just, I was assuming he was just calling to like check in and see how I survived. And he was calling to let me know that Jeff had passed away.
Can you even process that? What does that even mean? Do you even remember that moment?
I don't remember that exact moment, but I can picture that night. I can remember calling my parents afterwards. I remember not believing it because this girlfriend that he had kept very secret was the one who had to find his brother on Facebook and reach out to him that way and like said, hey, can you call me? So that was like her introduction to his family. And she was the one who found him. So I feel very bad for her for that. Whatever I thought of their relationship and, you know, how unhealthy that was. I could not, like, that's traumatic. I thought, wow, that could have been me. Right. If I had not left a year and a half ago, that could have been me. That could have been Peyton. They could have walked in on this.
And he literally drank himself to his death.
He was, it was 0.36 was his blood alcohol content. His girlfriend said he'd been yellow for weeks. But he said he was fine and refused treatment. And then just like me, she had no idea he drank like he did. She found a duffel bag of handles in a closet after he had passed. But I think what was crazy for me in those moments, like thinking about just the God moments in that, 6 weeks prior, our dog had died out of the blue. She got sick one night, the day before kindergarten was starting.
Oh, no.
And we had to put her to sleep. And my daughter was devastated. It was like the worst day ever.
Oh, no.
And 6 weeks later, how grateful was I for that day?
Right.
Because it helped her understand the concept of death. It helped her understand grief. Like we had talked through all of that 6 weeks prior. And so it made it easier to explain to her what had happened, help her understand the permanence a little bit more. And because she was just barely five, like I could be very concrete with her, and you know, they don't need the extra details.
How awful though to process that and then also have to break it to your daughter.
Yeah.
So you walk through this loss, this weird in between, this is my ex, but clearly I wanted the best for him. Like, this is not how I saw our life going. You're not the quote unquote widow, right? But you are still the mother of his children and the woman who thought she would be spending the rest of her life with this man. So how does that look moving on? And when did you decide, I think I might be ready to meet someone else?
It's funny you pick up on that, because that is, I think, one of the weirder things for me to still process to this day, because I'm not a widow because we were divorced, but people consider me that. I sometimes feel that
it's
way.
It's a huge loss, of course.
It's a huge loss.
There may not be a word for it.
Yeah, it's strange.
Yeah.
So as far as how then we start dating again, I had actually, just before our divorce was finalized, obviously dating apps were not a thing when he and I were married. So I was fascinated by them. And I was like, well, this will be fun. Let's just do this for a little while.
Every single woman listening to this is like,
trust me. I learned that very quickly.
How adorable. Real fast.
So I did that for a few months, went on several very bad dates, a couple good dates. And then when he passed away, my hands were very full for a while.
Right.
And so I hadn't been on a date for a while. And my now husband reached out maybe like 4 or 5 months after he had passed. And I was like, well, I haven't been out with anyone in a while and I could use a good meal, which was crazy because I never agreed to a first date meal with anybody. As a single mom, I'm not wasting my parents babysitting on a bad date. So we always did coffee at lunch. We were there for over 2 hours. Mm-hmm. I've never been on a first date, much less any date, I don't think, talking to a man for 2 hours. I came home that night. I told my mom, I was like, I don't even know if I liked him, but I had a really good time.
It's a plus.
Which is a very different story than my husband
and
will tell you.
And he cringes every time you tell that story. I didn't know if I liked you.
What? He says I'm lying. He says there's no way. He said, you texted me before I was even home. I said, that's because I'm polite and it's my job to thank you for a nice evening.
100%. And you whatever you need to tell yourself. Whatever.
And when
you
I got home,
do.
I was going to be busy with children. So I had to do it before I got home.
And surprise, now you're married.
Right.
How long did that take?
So we got engaged after a year. It was just really, and I think anyone who is dating with young children can relate to this. I think for me, my biggest thought going in was I'm either going to find someone and it's going to work out when these kids are really little. And this is just going to be the man that they remember and the only person they know, or they're going to be grown adults. Like there's probably no in between. And I'm comfortable with that.
Yeah.
With Josh, it was just easy, but I was always waiting for the other shoe to drop. I was waiting for one tantrum too many. We've got my son who is almost three, like knee deep in temper tantrums. Our first vacation, I won't even call it a vacation because it was with my ex-husband's family. This is how wonderful.
Oh gosh. Wow.
He gets a speeding ticket on the way there. And then my 3-year-old throws up in the back of the car in the middle of the night. We get to the hotel that night, he has to get the car seat out and we like clean it in the hotel laundry room.
Oh, awful.
I'm like, okay, good. This is the
That's
end.
That's baptism, my friend. That sounds like an amazing extended family though.
Yes.
You are married now and you have another baby.
We had another baby.
And how did that work for your in-laws, your former in-laws? Was that tough for them? Was that a joyful thing that their grandchildren got a new family? What does that look like?
I think outwardly at first, I think his brother was always supportive and wonderful. Yeah. Outwardly, I think his parents were polite and they knew he was a great guy.
Yeah. And what else can you hope for?
Right. And I am sure as a parent, that was hard for them because they're not seeing their son raise these children. They're not seeing their son be the man that this guy is.
Right.
So I'm sure that was hard. And we always had kind of a strained relationship, but I do still see them a couple times a year.
Is there any talk of adoption?
So it's funny you say that. We have kind of left that up to, it's not something we talk about.
Yeah.
And in fact, our household gets very confusing because we've got three last names in it.
Oh, is that right?
So we all kind of go by anything.
Okay.
Because I did not change my name. When he and I got married,
the first
I didn't
or the,
want to like
the second time. Okay,
the second time,
yeah.
I changed my name back when I got divorced, so I no longer had the same name as my two children.
So you've got maiden name, first two kids' name, husband and youngest son with the same name.
Yes,
gotcha.
Yes.
Okay.
So it gets very confusing. We all answer to anything,
right?
And I kind of set it up as if the older two want to change their name one day, I will so happily support that and we'll all do it. And it'll be a big family thing at the courthouse.
Right, right, right.
And I think until that time, because I don't know how they're going to feel. I mean, my oldest is almost 11. And I think what's really hard to watch as she gets older is she obviously gets to learn more every year. I don't think there is a 10-year-old, well, I'm sure there are 10-year-olds sadly out there, but there are not many 10-year-olds out there who understand as much about alcohol as she does.
Right.
And she's been having a really interesting kind of moment realizing when I turn 11, I will know Josh longer than I knew my dad. And that's been really hard for her.
Yeah.
And such a big thing to feel and understand. And with kids that lose someone at such a young age, like it's a delayed grief.
Of course.
Sure, she was sad for a little bit, but then she goes on with her normal life.
Right.
And it's kind of as she gets older, that grief manifests in different ways. There's phenomenal programs out there. In fact, we're really lucky here in Richmond. There's a program called Comfort Zone Camp that they work up and down the East Coast now. And I think they have some stuff on the West Coast too. But they're based here in Richmond. And it is literally a free camp, an overnight camp for kids who have lost a family member, a parent, a sibling.
Oh, how special.
So special. And they get big buddies who just like stay with them for the weekend and they do fun things, but then they also have what are called healing circles and they get to just talk about their experiences. And she's gone to that several times and just looks forward to that every year. My son, on the other hand, it's going to be interesting as he gets older. He's almost 8 and he was so young.
Right.
And so
he
doesn't know any different.
He
was 2.5 when he passed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not even 2.5. So tiny.
Yeah.
And hadn't been with him since he was 8 months old.
Right.
Really.
Right.
So really didn't grow up with him at all. But what's funny is I just always assumed he would be the one to acclimate the fastest with Josh and call him dad. And he's the one who just, he's always Josh. And I don't think he means anything by it.
Right.
It's just literally.
It is what it is.
When we dated, he was Josh and
right.
It was too hard for him to change. We have to remind them now that the baby like cannot call him Josh.
No, that's weird.
He has to call him dad.
Yeah, that's
you
weird.
You guys need to get better.
We can't do that. So what do you wish you'd known? You know, because I imagine at every stage of this, when you had a newborn, when you had an 8-month-old, when you had a 2.5-year-old, at every stage kind of loss, different losses of that same dad, that you felt more and more lost or adrift or alone and uncertain about what would come next, or maybe questioning, did I do everything I could do? Did I do the wrong thing? What would you say either to you several years ago or to someone listening who's in those same shoes? What do you wish you could have heard?
I think what I tell people now when I get DMs or people say, oh, you're so strong to leave. I couldn't do that. The honest truth is you are strong whether you stayed or you left.
Oh, I love
that. The mother who has to hold all of that weight and is just trying to figure out how to keep her family together, keep her family afloat. It's hard to know, is it best to do that on my own or with this partner who is kind of a crappy partner?
Right.
Because you married that person for a reason. And that reason, like that person's still there, but they're just stuck inside of addiction. And it is so hard to watch that person fall apart. Like that, it was terrible. It was terrible. But it's still hard. You can't compare your situation to someone else's and say, well, that person could go because of X, or I can't go because of this. It's fine. Like, it takes so much strength to leave, but there's a totally different strength in staying and keeping it together for your family. And it's just figuring out what's right for you and when it's right for you. And if all the signs were there, like they were for me, and you missed them, it's okay. Like
right.
Sometimes I just like kick myself, but I can't.
You did the best you could with what you had. No one could do any better than what you were thrown into. You didn't choose any of this.
Right.
So where can people find you, find your books, find your story if they want to learn more?
So my books are on Amazon. I self-published them a couple years ago. I wrote my memoir, like I mentioned, mostly because there was nothing there for me.
Yeah.
And I just needed people to see that you can walk through it and you can do it. I am like obsessed with Glennon Doyle. And I have like read her books and followed her for years. I actually met her when I was knee deep in my divorce and we hugged and cried.
Yes.
And she's from Virginia. So like
oh,
her
I
whole family's
that.
There. I like hugged and loved on everyone. And she hugged in my kids. It's like, she's just incredible. And so her words like of, you know, we can do hard things. It's the next, you know, thinking about the next right thing.
Right.
I think that is kind of what got me through is I can't think about, oh my gosh, what if he's a deadbeat for them for the next 15 years? I would have fallen apart.
Right.
It is day by day by day. And that's really what the book is about. You get through it and suddenly, oh my gosh, I've driven to work for a whole month and I haven't cried on the car to work. That's incredible.
Tiny victories.
Yes. And focusing on that. And, you know, I think the second book kind of wrote itself over the last year. I had started an Instagram account, The Other Side of Motherhood. And every week I was doing a divorce tip. And they kind of just wrote themselves. And I have a dear friend who went through a very difficult divorce. And a lot of the tips actually came from things she had learned. You know, things like creating a new email address and setting up a PO box so that your ex cannot access things and doesn't know them.
Mm.
You can still use your old email address to communicate with him.
Right.
But set up a new one for everything else. Just like so many tips that just I didn't think about.
Yeah.
That are just phenomenal. And so I ended up putting all of those into a book, just broken out with different legal things to be thinking about, self-care, parenting, and just all of the things that you don't know.
So you are The Other Side of Motherhood on Instagram and Ashley Adams on Amazon. Is there another way to find you, or should people feel free to reach out and do that Glennon Doyle virtual cry?
Oh my gosh, DM yes, hug? Yes. Yeah, my first book is called The Other Side of the Door. That's where the motherhood handle comes from. The Other Side of the Door is my book. And then Divorce Easier Said Than Done is the book with the tips in it. But yes, my DMs are always open and always like happy to walk through with people, to sit in that pain with them, because it can just feel so isolating. So thank you for the opportunity to share.
Oh, I'm so thankful, and I'm so glad that you, even without the resources that you've created, got here. I mean, that's why I imagine you fought so hard. Who knows how many people are listening to this and seeing themselves, seeing their own marriage, seeing their siblings' marriage. And I think there's a lot of hope to be had. But if nothing else, I want people to be able to find you. So we will make sure we put all of those links in our show notes so people know how to get to you.
Well, thank you, Anne. I so appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely. Your vulnerability is going to make a big difference. I'm confident. But not all at once-ers. Can I call you that? Do we have a name? I'll tell you what, if you find a great name for folks who listen to this podcast, I will send you something sweet in the mail, because I think all my creativity is focused on remembering what day it is, and we see how well that's going. But not all at once, listeners, thank you for being here. I am hopeful that you took as much away from this episode as I did. Ashley is more than willing to come back on Patreon if you have direct questions about grief, divorce, substance abuse, when to stay, when to go, how to be safe, how to find an attorney, what to do when starting over and figuring out dating apps for the first time. She has lots of stories and insight to share, and I'm excited at the thought of bringing her more directly to you at patreon.com/butnotallatonce. Keep your eyes or ears or electronic devices peeled for an episode breaking down Prince Harry's recent interview with armchair expert Dax Shepard, his podcast. If I had only read the headlines about the interview, I think I would have a very different perspective on what actually happened. So we're going to lean on facts, something tabloid writers don't always love to do when they craft a storyline. We're going to use direct quotes. We're going to put things in context, and we are not going to paint every side of the story with bold strokes. There's a lot of nuance, but a lot of information in that podcast, and I would recommend you listen to it if you haven't already. You know where to find me, butnotallatonce.com, butnotallatonce on all the places, driving around Greenville, South Carolina, trying to figure out what day it is. I look forward to talking to you next week, if not sooner. Take good care.